I'm left with a mix of appreciating the beauty, but feeling that deep angst of desperation, even when contentment in life, to feel whole, to feel right, is missing despite all of our attempts to fill it. That song helpfully reflecting what the writer of Ecclesiastes that we just read, a writer from 3,000 years ago, who set out on an experiment to find satisfaction, to find wholeness in life, in everything under the sun, without looking any further beyond it, and he comes up empty. And so it is so good to be together. Let me add my welcome, especially if these things are new for you, because we're putting this series on so that we can reflect on the big things of life together, where true life is found. Are there any dead ends? What are they? Let's spot them. Where is the hope? Where is the path? Which I hope you're not surprised. We're going to open the Bible to see what it has to say about that. So that's our journey over these 4 weeks. The first 3 weeks, considering what the Bible will say is a dead end, before really unpacking the hope in the fourth week. But before I go any further and we push into this topic, let me pray for us. Lord God, we live in your world, the world that you have made with every bit of beauty, like song and lyric. All the good things have been made by your hand. And so as we come together, I want to ask again that you would give us clear minds and honest hearts to reflect on our lives in light of what you say to us about the world, about reality, about history. Give us, please, the humility to do that honestly, but most of all, lead us to hope. Bless us in this time together, we ask. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, we did survey the community and ask, where do you find the good life, the satisfying life? And we're working through the top answers. This week, we're dealing with the answer of, essentially, money. Now, most of us have heard the expression, money can't buy happiness, yeah? But I also suspect that most of us secretly disagree and kind of go, well, give me a truckload just to prove it false, right? In fact, I'll be the one who figures out how to do it, how to make it work. Because after all, as this kind of slogan tells us, whoever said money can't buy happiness clearly never went shopping. And I'm seeing some heads nod there. Maybe we're just not doing it right. Maybe you just got to know how to spend it. And we'll actually come back to this. But before we remove or dismiss any link between money and satisfaction, there is some evidence for us to consider. For a number of years now, people collect all sorts of data, and so it kind of helps us with some analysis. Here's a study that has been collecting people's reported life satisfaction levels from across the globe over time. And what is very obvious from this chart is that, you know, kind of 2, 3, 4 out of 10, we find the African countries. And whereas we find up in the 7s, 8s, 9s, Australia, US, Netherlands. And so what is clear is that there is a higher reported level of satisfaction amongst wealthier nations than poorer nations. And the Bible agrees, viewing material poverty as a travesty, as evidence of a world that's not right at its core. And so in a very real sense, more money for some people really will lead to increased life satisfaction, particularly those who are not able to meet the most basic needs. But what about us? What about our country when we zoom in? Because after all, the bulk of us in our country are well above the poverty line. Well, this is what we find when we just zoom in on Australia over the last 15 years. It's a pretty solid kind of 7 and a bit. It's fairly stable, but if you look, if there is a trend, the trend is downward. Now, here's the striking thing about that trend over this period, because at the same time, our country has grown richer every single year. It's 29 years and counting since the last recession. which means GDP has grown every year, the mark of a growing or healthy economy. And we have more money with us today than we did 15 years ago, 50 years ago, 100 years ago. You might think, not in my pocket, not in my balance, but yes, yeah, we are. We have three times the income than the people in the 1950s. Not because of inflation, in real terms. It's seven times as much as those living in 1900. The average worker in 1900 would have to work a bit over 3 hours to buy a chicken. For us, half an hour. Capitalism has created wealth, generated more wealth, and the tide lifts everyone's boats up. To put simply, we are living in one of the wealthiest parts, in one of the wealthiest nations, in the wealthiest moment in history. Take that in. We are living amongst the wealthiest people ever. And so surely if wealth was the answer to rich life, real life, satisfying life, wholeness, we would have smashed it out of the park by now. We would have proved it beyond doubt. Now, yes, we might be punching it at a 7 and a bit in Australia compared to 4 in Afghanistan. But I want to suggest that as you dig into even the people who said 7, 8, and as you look around our country, there's a whole lot of evidence to suggest that dissatisfaction is felt on a rate never seen before. Evidence that to be stuffed is not the same as being satisfied. I could give you a bunch. Let me just race through a few. Loneliness is an increasing problem, particularly in the West. Where now in the UK, in the government, they have Minister for Finance, Minister for Health, Minister for Education, the Minister for Loneliness. Wow. How did we get there? And it's not just in the UK, it's across the West, it's in our backyard. A whole bunch of us 2 weeks ago in church just got out and pretty much knocked on every door in the surrounding suburbs of church. Just wanted to say hello, introduce ourselves to people and so on, have a conversation. And we saw time and time again that comment coming back, I'm lonely. Family breakdown. Now, the family unit, which for millennia has been the bedrock of stable societies, is unraveling like never seen before. I'm not intending any judgment in this comment, just an observation. But one of my kids has a best friend who has 4 mums, and I think it might be up to 5 now. And until recently didn't even think he had a biological father, and so now he's moved around all these different homes. Levels of depression and anxiety have never been higher. Now, be careful, because the cause for mental illness is complex. Be very wary of simplistic diagnosis and solutions. But in terms of the impact that our mental health has on our lives and our satisfaction levels, in these reports which measure people's satisfaction levels, the biggest thing, the biggest factor that determines our life satisfaction, mental health. More than money. The biggest thing is mental health. What about suicide? The leading cause of death for men aged between 15 and 44 is by their own hand. All this to say, the time of greatest material prosperity ever clearly doesn't equal greatest satisfaction and wholeness ever. And yet, our community, when asked, what's the way to the good life, says, money. Why? Why do we think it's the answer? Well, for at least 3 reasons, let me race through them. Security, status, and purpose. Security. Having money gives us a sense of control in a world that's out of control. It gives me a sense of security in the face of an unknown and scary future. You know, so if I get sick, the money that affords me private health is going to afford me the best care and the quickest road to recovery. If my car breaks down, then to have enough money means I'll just quickly be able to get it repaired and off I go with my life. Or if you watch the ads, if there's a spider in your car, just go buy a new one. There you go, Adrian. Just get a new car, problem solved. Money gives us a sense of control in a world that around us is out of control. We turn to it for status. We like to tell ourselves that we march to the beat of our own drum. I am me, my own man, my own woman. It's a lie. We live getting so much of our sense of self-worth by looking around, comparing ourselves to each other, and how am I doing compared to you, compared to him, compared to her. And so if I earn more, if I have more money, if I have the more powerful job that has the permanent office in the corner with the glass windows, you know those ones? Not with the plebs out in the petitions with the hot desks. I feel better about myself. And I earn more to kind of drive a nicer car home to a bigger house in a nicer suburb, and I feel better about myself. So much of our self-worth is based on where we are on the status ladder, and money pushes us up. But thirdly, and I want to suggest this purpose one is particularly true in more recent generations, there's been a shift where generally the baby boomers were more about building their quarter-acre kingdoms, the house, the car, the boat, all the stuff to put in it, whereas millennials, they're not about collecting stuff, they're more about collecting meaningful experiences. And for good reason, in one sense, because they've actually seen firsthand the emptiness of the bigger house, the bigger car, all the stuff. They're the product of the broken families of previous generations. And so what they value most, what we, some of us, value most, is not the stuff, but time, giving ourselves to meaningful experiences and activities. But in order to do that, I need money to support myself. So I can go to Nepal and volunteer in an orphanage, so that I can give myself to the cause of the environment and so on. Lots of good causes, been known as the cause generation. Money, therefore, is the necessary purpose enabler. And it allows me to find my true purpose and pursue it. So we turn to money as the answer for these reasons and more, but here's the thing. It doesn't work. It just doesn't work. Now, Jesus is going to diagnose the problem for us at its deepest level, and we'll come to that in a moment, but let me just offer three more basic reasons for why it doesn't work. Firstly, something what psychologists will call adaptation. I think you'll recognize it pretty quickly. Because you get a pay rise and it feels good. Oh, yeah. You go shopping and you buy that new thing. Oh, that really did give me a hit. You buy the new car or the newer car or the phone, or you do the holiday or you get the reno, and it really does feel good. But it's short-lived, and it fades very quickly. So that what was special and exciting yesterday is ordinary today, and it's invisible tomorrow. Do you experience this? We do, don't we? 15 years ago, before the iPhone was a thing, before we'd even heard of it, I had a job which gave me a BlackBerry. Does anyone remember a BlackBerry, know what a BlackBerry was? It was a mobile phone, kind of the size of a brick, because it actually had a full-on keyboard on it. Not a screen, but actually a QWERTY keyboard on it. And it was the first mobile phone that had been connected to the internet, well, popular anyway. And I remember the time I was with a bunch of mates. In fact, I've seen some of you here. I don't know if you remember it. I'm hanging out, and I pulled this thing out of my pocket. There were very wide pockets to pull the thing out. And I went, check this out. And I pull up Google, and I check the surf conditions for tomorrow and the next week. And my mates, their minds are just going, kaboom. Like, we had to sit there and wait for it to load, to load, to load. They'd be like, what? Today I could pull out my iPhone 11 and play a full movie in high def instantly, and no one cares. It's a thing, isn't it? Isn't this our experience? We get something and it's good, but it fades. And then actually to get the next hit, I need something more, but actually I need something bigger and better. Because adaptation is subject to the cycle of diminishing returns. There's a phrase for it which I quite like. It's called the hedonic treadmill. It's a very good term, hedonic treadmill. Hedonism, the pursuit of pleasure, and a treadmill. In order to get pleasure, you've got to jump on this treadmill, you've got to buy the next thing, do the next thing, but you've got to keep running because you need the next thing. And if you just sit there, man, you're going to fall off this thing. You just got to keep running and you never get anywhere. Whoever has wealth never has wealth enough. That was figured out 3,000 years ago. It doesn't work. Second reason it doesn't work is the status thing. I mentioned we look to each other to kind of base our sense of self-worth and feel good about ourselves. And you'd think that the more that you have, the better that you would feel, as there are more people below you on the ladder. But instead, this is what instead tends to happen. As we're in this kind of circle and we come into more wealth, we don't stay there and feel good compared to these people. We actually move into different circles, wealthier circles. But then it loses its effect. For example, you get a pay rise and now you can take your kids out of public school and you can put them in private school. But now, instead of mixing with people who for holidays kind of went to Crescent Head once a year or nowhere because they couldn't afford it, now you're mixing with people who ski around Europe. And you're like, I can't ski around Europe. And this status thing actually doesn't work. Yes, it pushed you up the rung on the status ladder, but there's always more people above. It just doesn't work. Thirdly, the security thing. Money can function as security, right? So for the bulk of us, if our car does break tomorrow, we won't be going hungry for the week. We'll be able to get it fixed. We'll be able to keep going with life. There is something about it, but it's not as dependable as we like to think. To illustrate this, on the survey, here is the life satisfaction ratings of the Netherlands, top, UK, France, Greece. Look at my Greek mate here who's chuckling. What happened here where people were almost 70% and boom, more than halved? What happened, Greek? What, Greece fell over? Yeah. And how did Greece feel about that? Terrible. The recession has come, the economy's fallen over, and look, it's still impacting people's sense of satisfaction today. 2008, we saw the global financial crisis, and somehow Australia was kind of not impacted like the rest of the world. But it was a clear example that what appears to offer security is paper thin. It's fickle, that our world markets are far more volatile and susceptible to crashing than we would realise and like to think. Or even at a personal level, if the economy keeps running but you lose your job, where some kind of technology or modernisation means you're no longer needed, or you lose your health and the ability to work your job, your stocks, your shares, your super, it can disappear overnight. Wealth is not as dependable as we'd like to think. One of my favourite proverbs in the Bible says this: cast but a glance at riches and they are gone, for they will surely sprout wings and fly off to the sky like an eagle. Especially if you've got four kids. It's just kind of off it goes. So we turn to it because we think it'll give the hit. We think it'll give status and security. It doesn't work. But here's where I want to bring us to the biggest reason, the deepest reason why it doesn't work, and it's what Jesus offers. It's there in your handout, if you've got that, or in your Bible. Turn over to Luke chapter 12. Someone in the crowd said to Jesus, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." Ricky Gervais, the comedian, has that joke: where there's a will, there's a relative. Have you experienced that? I think many of us will have come across some kind of conflict around a will. Jesus replied, "Man, who appointed me?" I don't know how he said man. Man, who appointed me a judge or an arbiter between you? He basically says, I didn't come to referee your catfights. Then he said to them, watch out. Be on your guard against all kinds of greed. Life does not consist in an abundance of possessions. There it is. There's Jesus' big reason for why money, financial freedom, it's not the path. Life does not consist, true life, full life, it's not in an abundance of possessions. And I believe today he would say to the millennials, it's not in abundance of meaningful experiences. Now, notice where Jesus locates the problem of this approach. He says, watch out for all kinds of greed. There's the problem. The problem isn't in money or material things. The problem is greed. Where's greed? Where do you find the problem of greed? You don't go out there and grab it. It's here. It's in us. It's in our hearts. For Christmas, we gave our kids the game Monopoly. The card version, which is a way quicker version than the thing we probably grew up playing. Man, I tell you, I don't think I've seen them play it without it coming to fisticuffs, right? Tears, arguments, squabbles. And Bri and I are looking at ourselves going, oh, what have we done? Like, we've introduced the corrupting forces of Monopoly into our family and it's just blown it all up. We're not saying that. I'm going, look what Monopoly's doing. It's drawing out the corrupted nature of our kids. It wasn't as though they got to a certain age and Monopoly corrupted them or society did something or the advertising. No. All of that just taps into what's here. What's at the core of us. And here's why greed is such a tricky disease, deadly disease. Because a symptom of it is that you're blind to it. Greed is this deadly sickness, but a symptom of the sickness is that you can't actually see it in yourself. I mean, how easy is it to spot greed everywhere else? Yeah? Oh, look at them, they're doing that again, and they've updated to that, and they're doing this, and me, I just needed to update my phone. Me, I just needed to... Jesus says, watch out. Greed is so deceptive and it's deadly. And to pursue life through it is dumb. Because he goes on to tell a parable, a story to illustrate this, verse 16. The ground of a certain rich man yielded an abundant harvest. He thought to himself, what shall I do? I've no place to store my crops. Then he said, this is what I'll do. I'll tear down my barns and build bigger ones. And there I'll store my surplus grain. And I'll say to myself, you have plenty of grain laid up for many years. Take life easy. Eat, drink, and be merry. A pretty straightforward story so far. And whilst it's an agricultural one, it's no different to the modern middle-class Australian dream, is it? Work as hard as you can, invest well, so you can retire as early as possible and live it up. Because after all, you're worth it. You've earned it. You deserve it. It's kind of the mantra of Frank Sinatra, he who dies with the most toys wins. But what does Jesus say that God will say to that person? Verse 20, but God said to him, you fool. This very night your life will be demanded from you. Then who will get what you have prepared for yourself? This is not just dumb. This is foolishness in its extreme. Can you imagine that you stand before the living God and the only two words, or at least the first two words that he addresses you with are, "You fool"? This is the only time in the Bible where God addresses someone directly with those words. Who's the person? It's the person who thought that the answer to life was finance, was money, was what it could bring. Which means we are living in a very, very sick community. I'll come to that in a moment, but why is it foolish? Why does Jesus say it's foolish? Well, it doesn't work when you're living for the reasons that we've considered. But here's the big reason that Jesus brings us. It doesn't work when you're dead. One nanosecond after you take your last breath, you will realize that a life that's pursued financial gain, abundance, experiences, was the most horrific waste of a life. And that everything you thought you had through your money is stripped away. It's not there. You're naked and you're barren and you're bankrupt before God. See, what's the problem with what this farmer did? There is no thought of God or anyone else on the planet. This has been someone who has pursued the good life for them through materialism. But here's the thing. Even if you did manage to get yourself an 8 or a 9 on the life satisfaction chart, even if you could dodge the economic crisis and live in Norway and make it all go really well, Jesus will say this: what good is it? What good will it be for someone to gain the whole world yet forfeit their soul? Anything and everything that our wealth afforded us, good for nothing when it comes to the next life. And this is where the things of Jesus will only start to make sense. It's if you allow the possibility that this life is not all there is. That you don't only live once, that there is a life to come, and this life is an eternal one. Though we're in an increasingly secular culture, and I could show you stats on that, I reckon, particularly on the coast, as I get around and talk to people one-to-one, people go, I reckon there is something more. I reckon this life isn't it. There's got to be, isn't there? Yes. You're not just a bag of chemicals soaking up a tiny moment of time. You have been made for eternity. And Jesus says the way that you approach spiritual things, the way that you pay attention to the spiritual dimension to your life of reality, of history, will determine eternity. And so what good is it to have the Aussie dream if it's gone in a moment? Jesus calls us to measure our lives on the scale of eternity, not 80, 90 brief years. And of course, one of the key evidences for a life beyond this one is his resurrection. And so if you're wondering about that, get along to life that Adrian mentioned, where we check out the evidences for us. That our community said finance, money, materialism is one of the top ways to the good life means we are very sick. We have a sickness that will impact us now, but beyond the grave into eternity. So what's the medicine? What's the hope? Well, the good news is Jesus brings that, and we will be unpacking this some more, particularly in a couple of weeks' time. But we do get something of it here in the passage. Because look at verse 21, how he finishes this parable. He says, this is how it will be with whoever stores up things for themselves. So that's this foolish man who's pursued materialism, but is not rich toward God. There's your comparison of two people, the path of materialism or being rich toward God. There's the answer. But what does it mean? What does it mean to be rich towards God? Here's what it doesn't mean. It doesn't mean that God needs your money, as though he somehow lacked something and you need to top it up and be rich towards him, give him lots of money, do lots of stuff for him, and you'll be okay with him. No, no, no. It's not even just to be rich to your neighbor, to be generous with those around you. And then I'll be satisfied and then God will be okay with me. No, no, no. I take it Jesus will tell us what it means as he rolls on. If you've got a Bible, he speaks some more about money and possessions and so on and how we're to deal with it. And then he sums it up in verse 32. I think I've got it on the screen here, where he says, don't be afraid, little flock, for your Father has been pleased to give you the kingdom. Sell your possessions and give to the poor. Provide purses for yourselves that will not wear out, a treasure in heaven that will never fail, where no thief comes near and no moth destroys. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. And so he's contrasting the person who has a treasure that is here in this life, in the things of this world, with the person who treasures God. The person whose ultimate treasure is God. Now, this will, Jesus say, involve a radical change in the person. So that when God is your ultimate and you cling to him no matter what, and you hold looser and looser and looser to everything else, when you cling to him and your affections are stirred and directed to him and your honor is concerned for him and your service is for him, everything changes. Maybe not overnight, and maybe not perfectly, but things change, and things change with our relationship with our money. And Jesus says the great antidote to greed is to give it away, to be generous, to not hoard it. And so, yes, he does say, sell your possessions and give to the poor. Now, in the first century, they didn't have banks, they didn't have super, they didn't have stocks. Possessions is where all of their wealth was. And so today he would say, give of your wealth. It doesn't just need to be the stuff in your home, but give your wealth away. But notice the order. He doesn't say, give your stuff away and then you'll be satisfied and God will accept you. No, no, no. Verse 32, he says, since your Father has been pleased to give you the kingdom, give away your wealth. Now, this is massively important, because he's not saying, give away your stuff, stop being greedy, start being generous, here's three tips, and then you'll be satisfied and God will accept you. No, no. The only way that a naturally greedy, God-ignoring heart can actually have God as our treasure is to have a radical experience of his grace, of his goodness and kindness and mercy to us. That's what it means when he says, your Father has been pleased to give you the kingdom. That's shorthand for referring to God has been pleased to give you every one of his blessings that he's promised. Every single one. Not to withhold anything from you. And at the heart of these blessings is the blessing of forgiveness from a God that we have rebelled against. And this happens, we're going to unpack it some more in the coming weeks, through Jesus, through his life and death, so that all of our greed could be washed away, that we could be reconciled with God and know him. Look at verse 32, three things he says. Know God as our Father, a Father who loves. As a shepherd, don't be afraid, little flock. You have a shepherd who will provide for all of your needs, and he's been pleased to give you the kingdom. He's your king. Now, he's always been your king. He's the king over everyone, but the gift is that you would receive his rule over your life gladly. that you would rejoice in it, that you would submit to it, and that you would find real life in it. See, this thing happens as you come to know God through Jesus, that this counterintuitive thing happens with our money. Whereas we thought the answer was getting as much and hoarding it for ourselves and our kind of quarter acre kingdom and the little family and all of that, we actually find that to give it away is deeply satisfying. Because Jesus said it's more blessed to give than to receive. But not just any old giving. There's lots of generous people around there. Those who would give as a response to what God has given us. Generosity and a life that wells up and flows out from a radical experience of God's love for us. And notice what else changes, gets reoriented. It's our fears. Because he's able to say, don't be afraid. Don't fear. He's just been talking about material possessions, food to eat, clothes to wear, houses to eat, all that kind of stuff. And he can say, don't be afraid. Why? Well, because those things we turn to money for, security, status, purpose, they're deeply satisfied in God. We have security by knowing the God who controls every detail of this world and the future. Not bank balances, not economies. I'm known by God. Status. We're no longer looking around us for how we fit when God says, you're mine. I love you. I cherish you. And I value things differently to the world. I don't care how much money you've got or not. I don't care what you look like. I don't care what you've achieved or not. If you've come to me through forgiveness in Jesus, you're mine. Status, it's blown out of the water. And purpose. Our life's purpose, we realize, is not to scratch every itch that needs satisfying. We come to realize how twisted it is that I'll gain satisfaction and meaning and purpose by going and doing some charitable work. But actually, I was made to know God, to experience knowing God and being known by him. Jesus says to our community, to us, to me, money, stuff, materialism, it's a dead end. Don't go there. Don't stand before God and be addressed, you fool. There is something so much more to be had now, yes, but particularly in the life to come. Let me finish by illustrating this with a story from a pastor who lived two centuries ago. You might have heard this before, but it's a good one and makes the point powerfully. I'll quote him directly. He says, I was having a talk with a man who was young, rich, and in every enjoyment of every good thing this world could give him, and who maintained that religion was a melancholy thing. I can't stand your Christian people, he said. Their religion doesn't make them cheerful or agreeable, and they're always in trouble, moaning and groaning and complaining. Come along with me, my friend, I said. We will visit one of your complaining Christians. I took him to a wretched, fireless garret where beside the empty grate sat a poor old woman, doubled up with rheumatism and groaning with the pain. Oh, she said, it's so bad, and it never gets any better. Well, my friend, I said, look at this young man. He is rich, he's healthy and strong, he has every pleasure the earth can give him, and he is without God in the world. Tell me now, would you change with him? To which the woman replied, change with him? There's a woman who had been captured by a greater treasure. The ultimate treasure, God himself, where there is no limits to his goodness. where we will never come to the edges of his knowledge and power, where we will never go beyond the depths of his love. See, with God, you will never grow bored or dissatisfied. The thing of us getting something new, being excited by it, but it wearing off, and I need more, and I need more. There's something right about that in us. The problem is we've just latched on to the wrong thing. We've been made to know our God. And here's the thing. You never get to the end of knowing God. There is always more of him to be had, to be understood. He is our infinite God who has given us himself that we can know truly now and we will know into eternity. This is something that as a church we... This is what we're about. This is what church is about. What churches of the Bible has always been about for 2,000 years. A bunch of sinners who have searched for anything and everything in the wrong places and have come to find it in Jesus. And so it's the thing that brings us the greatest joy. And I want to finish by asking you to throw your eyes to the screen as we hear a story from just one of the people among us who have come through this journey to find what they were looking for in Jesus. Let's look at Claudia's story.